This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday on Fresh Air, Ray Manzarek, who was the keyboard player with The Doors, told us a lot of great stories. One of those stories was about how singer Jim Morrison threw a TV at the control room window during The Doors' first recording session. So how did the head of the record company feel about that kind of behavior? Well, we asked Jack Holtzman, the founder of The Doors' record company, Elektra Records. Holtzman has a new book about Elektra called Follow the Music. Elektra started out as a folk and ethnic music label and first made its mark with such performers as Gene Ritchie, Theodore Bikel, Judy Collins, Tom Paxton, and Phil Oakes. Elektra's first big hit was the Doors single Light My Fire. What attracted a folk and classical music fan like Jack Holtzman to the Doors? Well, one thing was their version of the Brecht-Weil song Whiskey Bar.
Well, show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Oh, moon of all above, now must say goodbye. With love, I'll get on my mind. I must have.
I asked Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records, about the difficulties he faced working with Jim Morrison, who was talented, commercially successful, but often out of control.
From our standpoint, the difficulties in Jim's life and the way he expressed them were nothing as compared to the magic of the recordings. It was more than Light My Fire. The first Doors album was as close to a perfect album as I've ever been involved with. That album really pushed the envelope, and I was just so thrilled to be associated with it. And if there was a price to pay, that was okay with me. I had dealt with some outrageous artists before who had problems, and artists afterwards who had problems. And I found it best to keep my distance because I am the person who runs their record company, and I am the surrogate for the audience. And it's my job to make sure that things keep moving and that the artists are given the very best possible circumstances in which to record. And these are the issues that you have to deal with.
So you try to keep your distance in part so you could remain kind of the authority figure and not get too close with anyone.
Well, it makes it difficult if at some point you have to take a stand on something and you've been hanging out with them all the time. It erodes the special relationship that you have with them. And I think that the Doors appreciated that. I know Jim did. Before he went to Paris, he wanted to have sort of a farewell drinking session with me. Well, I'm smart enough not to have more than two with Jim Morrison because Jim's big enemy was alcohol. And he could be a prince. You could take him anywhere, but pour a few drinks into Jim, and he would go from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, and it was a real problem. So I would never try to match him drink for drink. But I remember this evening so vividly because we're sitting in this bar and we've each had our second drink, and Jim begins to taunt me, "Jack, you got to go more out on the edge." And I responded, "Jim, it's great being on the edge. The trick is not to bleed." And he sort of paused for a moment, and then we talked about movies.
Your record company, Elektra, was coordinating the Doors' tours and club dates. How would you deal with it if club owners got scared by Morrison's behavior and they wanted to cancel a date?
That never really happened until after the Miami incident.
When he was accused of exposing himself on stage.
That's correct.
And then what happened? And how did you handle it?
Well, what happened then was that a decency movement began in Florida. And there was a move among concert promoters to cancel Doors dates. And Doors dates were being canceled all over the country. And the Doors were in a major funk over this as well. You might imagine they would be. we just kept our cool. And we kept doing what we were supposed to do, be responsible for their records and supporting the boys wherever we could. There's not a lot you can do.
As the head of the record company, did you ever think, oh, well, maybe I should sit down with Jim Morrison and either try to discipline him or have a little talk with him about controlling himself more?
I thought that was better left to Ray Manzarek and the other members of the group. My function is not to discipline artists. My purpose is to be the midwife to their music, to support them, to help them in what they want to do creatively. If an artist asks me for an opinion, they know they'll always get an honest one. But I didn't think it was my place to get involved in what was essentially an internal group problem. I had seen this before. I had had other artists who had problems, and I always let the groups handle them.
Now, why did you decide to sign the Doors? What appealed to you about their music?
I went to see another group called Love, who was on Elektra. And Arthur Lee, who was the essential linchpin of that group, said, stick around for the other group that's on the bottom of the bill. And I did. And I wasn't really very impressed. But there was something about the group that kept bringing me back, and was only later that I figured out what it was. It was a kind of austerity in their musical line. If I were to compare the Doors to Architecture, I would say that they were the Bauhaus of 60s rock and roll. And I think that cleanliness of line and the expressive lyrics and the sheer beautiful simplicity of it is what has made the group last for over 30 years.
You were kind of unprepared for the incredible success that their first record had, and you had to call the pressing plants to get more records made very quickly because there was a big demand for them. What impact did that have on the company to have this big, sudden demand?
Well, first of all, it was wonderful, and I smiled so wide that my face hurt. But it was fantastic, because suddenly, after having struggled for 17 years with folk albums and singer-songwriters that had found increasing popularity, I was now riding the tiger. And the company was catapulted into a leading position. People were bringing artists to us. We got a first crack at things. And the logistics of pressing the records was left to my brother Keith, and we had relationships with pressing plants over the country, and we were able to get everything manufactured that we needed. But the important thing was that we were able to attract other artists because we had moved up one order of magnitude, I guess, on the scale of record companies. It was heady stuff.
When you found out about Jim Morrison's death, what responsibilities did you have? Did you have to take care of his personal effects or anything like that?
No, what I had to take care of first was my own emotion. Jim had been so special to me, and the band was phenomenal. And they had played such a vital and pivotal role in the growth of Elektra. Jim had been kind to me and my family. He would remember my son Adam's birthday and bring him a musical instrument and spend time with him. So I had to deal with that. But I also realized that I had to deal with what I thought was going to be a media circus. And indeed, it had been for Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. But I was lucky. I had 2 days to prepare. I knew about it on a Monday, and it wasn't public knowledge until Wednesday evening. So I sent my number two man, Bill Harvey, out to the West Coast. We had press releases prepared. We told the staff at the appropriate time. We had to tell Paul Rothchild, who had been their producer for all of the albums except the final one, L.A. Woman. And we got all of that stuff done. So when the phone call started coming and people wanted the radio interviews, we had determined that we were going to let the Doors do most of the talking, the Doors and Pam, and we would speak only about what their music meant to us and to their fans.
It must have been really interesting to be making records during the psychedelic era. And you were one of the record companies that had what you describe as the company freak. What was the job of the company freak?
The company freak was I led a much more 9-to-5 life, and the company freak sort of took over when I went home. The company freak's job was to be out on the street at all times, interpreting the company to the artists and the public, and giving us feedback as to what was being said. Company Freaks were instrumental in getting the Doors' Light My Fire single on that very, very important jukebox at Max's Kansas City. They were out and around and knew what was going on. Now, we had one in New York named Danny Fields, and he was an amazing man and still is. Danny began to take on A&R responsibilities. One of the things that happened at Elektra was that you could take on almost as much responsibility as you were willing to be responsible for. So Danny decided to start doing A&R, and he came up with the MC5 and, almost by accident, Iggy Pop and the Stooges.
In your book, you tell the story of what happened after you signed the MC5, and the MC5 was this, you know, revolutionary singing group that sang songs, you know, against the police and against the war, and used a lot of language that you couldn't say on the radio. For example, their record Kick Out the Jams had the word MF in it. So you had to come up with a creative solution to dealing with the fact that this was going to be unplayable on the radio. So you cut two versions of it, one for radio play, where the word MF was substituted with what? Brothers and Sisters?
Brothers and Sisters.
And
sometimes, unfortunately, in a couple of stores, the boxes were mislabeled.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a store, Nordstrom's, in the Midwest who happened to get the wrong box, and some mother brought the record back in, and Nordstrom sent all the records back. So the MC5 were very, very upset, and they took out an ad in the Detroit Free Press, which is like the underground newspaper, with a big Elektra logo, and it said the F word. I'm sorry, it wasn't Nordstrom's, it was Hudson's. F. Hudson's, and signed my name and the Elektra logo to it. Well, I contacted John Sinclair, the Great White Panther, and said, you can't do this, because suddenly Hudson's, in response, were sending back Judy Collins, Theodore Bickel, the Incredible String Band. Plus, they were sending back all my Nonesuch records. Mozart and Bach and all of his progeny were pouring back into the distributor's doors. And we had a disagreement. Later on, Danny Fields, the company freak, said, in defending the MC5, well, it's okay for Jim Morrison to take out his penis, but it's not okay for the MC5 to take out their ad, which was gloriously incongruous logic. But it was so charming, I just had to laugh. We gave a lot of permission, and we suggested to the MC5 that they might be happier elsewhere, and within 24 hours they had a new deal with Atlantic, and they went and drove them crazy.
Well, it must have been a thankless job in a way to try to run a business when the people who you were signing saw themselves as revolutionaries, and you, of course, were part of the establishment because you were a businessman. So, you know, who needs you, right?
Well, we may have been part of the establishment, and I may have been a businessman, but I was a music lover first, and if it hadn't been for music and a love of music and folk music and a passion for engineering, I would never have gotten involved in this. In 1948, when the LP was invented and inexpensive tape recording became available, it was possible for someone like me to grab his bar mitzvah money and start a record company. Interestingly enough, of the 500 to 600 labels that started at that time, only two survive today, where the threat of continuity has can be determined over the years, and that's Elektra and Atlantic. Elektra took political positions. I was horrified by the war in Vietnam. We took out radio editorials, which I spoke in my own voice. We took out paid ads in magazines. Kent State, I thought, was an abomination. I thought what happened at the 1968 Democratic Convention definitely needed to be addressed, and I thought that we as a label stand for something, and I just wanted to speak out and express my own dismay and outrage.
My guest is Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records. His new book is called Follow the Music. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Holtzman, the founder of Elektra Records, and he's written a memoir called Follow the Music, The Life and High Times of Elektra Records in the Great Years of American Pop Culture. So you started the label in 1950 when you were 19 years old with your bar mitzvah money. How much bar mitzvah money did you get?
Well, I got $300 and I cashed another $300 from a friend who just took his veteran's bonus and he put it into the company. I later bought him out, of course.
So what was your vision for the company at the age of 19?
At the age of 19, Well, my vision for the company was a personal vision. I wanted to make a good record, make enough money to make another good record, and go to the movies. I had no sense that I was going to be building a company this large. But what I wanted to do was to be able to not take crazy risks so I could stay in the game, and I would just follow the music and follow the industry and see where it would take me. I did not have a big vision. It was only later, after I had survived for 10 years, that I realized I might be able to take this someplace interesting. And I never knew where the idea was going to hit me. I remember the evening in 1963 when I was sitting in a restaurant waiting for someone, and I was right across the street from Carnegie Hall, and suddenly the idea of Nonesuch Records hit me. Based upon experience I had as a youngster in Annapolis, Maryland, going to St. John's College and not being able to afford two records, only being able to buy one. They were $5.95 in those days. And so in 1963, I decided to create a label with a unique personality, all fustiness removed, that would issue the kinds of records that I loved when I was going to school in my late teens and early 20s, and I called it Nonesuch. And it was an enormous success, so great a success that, unlike most situations with record companies whereby the pop music subsidizes classics, at Elektra, it was Nonesuch that subsidized Elektra and permitted us to go out and make rock and roll records.
In 1970, your label, Elektra, merged with Warner and Atlantic. Why did you decide to merge?
In the early 70s, I could see that being good at A&R and being effective marketeers, which is really just the connection of something wonderful with an audience that might want to hear it, was not going to be enough. We were running into problems of smaller independent distributors throughout the country folding and going out of business and not paying us, and I recognized that we would have to control our own distribution if Elektra was to survive as a label. And so I began to have talks with friends of mine, Mo Austin at Warner Brothers and the Erdogan brothers at Atlantic, about perhaps moving Elektra into an orbit where the three of us would have a merger for purposes of distribution only. What happened was that the Warner Atlantic labels were taken over by what became Warner Communications. And I met with Steve Ross, who was the chairman who sat on top of the entire Warner Communications mini-empire-to-be. And I liked Steve enormously. And I thought he had a real vision for the company. And the ability to control our own distribution, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, was enormously attractive to me. And on top of that, Steve gave me an opportunity to use my love and knowledge of technology throughout the entire company. So it was an irresistible opportunity, and I went for it. And unlike most people who have ended up having latter-day regrets about the selling of their company, I never did. I had a wild and wonderful ride.
After 23 years with Elektra Records, in 1973, you decided to get out. You write, "My instinct was it's time to go." You weren't quite 42 at the time. Why did you give up the company?
A couple of reasons. When I had been growing up, I had seen a movie called Holiday with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. And part of the premise of this movie was that this Cary Grant character wanted to take time off at midlife to find out why he was doing what he was doing. And that was always a ruling image for me, so that was always in the back of my head. In 1968, I had found Maui, and the Cary Grant image came back again. But I think the most important reason was that I had had 7 or 8 phenomenal years from 1966 to 1973, and I could tell that I had enjoyed a phenomenal cycle, and that cycle was not likely to continue into the 70s. And I just did not want to preside over the company when the music was going to be far less interesting.
Are you glad you got out, or do you have regrets?
No, I'm glad I did what I did.
Now, what are you doing now?
Well, I've had an interesting career ever since leaving Elektra. I went to Hawaii and lived there for 8 years and was chief technologist of Warner Communications, and I was deeply involved with Warner's entry into the cable business, and I did the initial research and development for Warner's on behalf of optical disc, which later became Laserdisc and the CD. And I was later chairman of Panavision, which is the world's preeminent designer and builder of camera systems for motion picture and television cinematography, and I got involved in a bunch of companies. And about 5 years ago, I came back to the Warner Music Group, and I'm their chief technologist.
So it hasn't exactly been retirement.
Well, I had it easy for the 7 or 8 years I was in Hawaii, and I'll never retire. My mind is just too active, and I'm too curious as an individual. But as long as people are putting out decent music, I'll be listening to it. Although I think there's been a dearth of really good music over the last few years, and I think that's as a result of the changes and the differences between making records in the 60s and 70s and making records today, where the control of the industry is in the hands of fewer people.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Jack Holtzman founded Elektra Records. His new book is called Follow the Music.